It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, an art exhibit at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum showcases art by veterans who are seeking to heal the wounds from post-traumatic stress disorder. First, a Dane County judge has struck down 2015's law that made Wisconsin a right-to-work state, effectively making it illegal for there to be mandatory union membership in private sector businesses. Sean Johnson is Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and he joins us now to talk about this development. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, what do we know so far about today's ruling on the state's right-to-work law?
It's all happened very fast. I don't think a lot of people were waiting for this to happen or expecting it to happen. What we know is that as of right now, Wisconsin's right-to-work law has been struck down. In no uncertain terms, the state attorney general, which was defending the law, is a Republican, is a supporter of the law, said that, quote, we're no longer a right-to-work state until we get this stayed. And so what he's talking about there is he wants to appeal the decision. But as of right now, Dane County Judge William Faust has issued a ruling that struck it down. Part of Judge Faust's ruling got at the idea that unions essentially had their property taken from them through the right to work law. And so now his decision, will undoubtedly be appealed.
And give us a little backstory here, Sean. Who filed this initial lawsuit?
This lawsuit was brought on behalf of the International Association of Machinists, the United Steelworkers, and the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO. So we've talked a lot about unions in Wisconsin the past several years. The most important distinction when we talk about right to work here is that we're talking about private sector unions. This is not the famed Act 10 law that kind of made Scott Walker famous, that caused all those protests in 2011. This is the law that they passed last year in 2015, which would ban mandatory union shops in the private sector. This is something that private unions didn't want. This is something that Governor Scott Walker had said repeatedly that he had no interest in, and a lot of Republicans said wouldn't happen under their watch. And then they moved very quickly last year and passed it as really their first act of this session of the legislature.
And you mentioned that Attorney General Brad Schimmel said, as of right now, Wisconsin is no longer a right-to-work state. So what does that mean on the ground in real time?
It means that life exists as it did before the right-to-work law was passed, and private unions who provide services for people who work there can require that people who work there pay dues. I'm not sure how tangibly that's going to happen, how that's going to be reflected in union shops in the private sector immediately. I think in terms of the legal battle, you can expect DOJ, Department of Justice, is going to move pretty swiftly to get it to the Court of Appeals. And, ultimately in Wisconsin, it would go to our state Supreme Court, since this was a state circuit court decision.
And any response from Governor Scott Walker yet on this, or maybe Robin Voss?
Yeah, so Governor Walker issued a tweet, I believe. And when Republicans talk about right to work, they talk about it as a worker freedom law, typically. I think that's what the governor's tweet referenced. Speaker Voss attacked Judge Faust. This is something that you've got to see a lot of during a lot of the initial laws that Republicans passed when they took power in 2011, is they would get challenged in Dane County court. And if they failed there, and a lot of them did, you saw Republicans like the speaker attacking Dane County activist judges. The Dane County legal community, not too fond of that terminology, but you're seeing that again today. What you're seeing from Democrats is celebration, even if they know that ultimately this thing may end up failing in the state Supreme Court and that the law may get upheld. They're saying this is good news today, that what we're ultimately talking about is protecting unions, and unions protect people's pay, and so they're celebrating this decision.
Talking right now with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Got some breaking news this afternoon. We're talking about the latest on a ruling that struck down Wisconsin's right-to-work law this afternoon. This from a Dane County judge. And Sean, you said ultimately it may be upheld in the state Supreme Court. Can you talk a little bit there about the composition of the court and what's likely to happen if it should go there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're going out on a limb when we say that that's a real possibility, because right now, and after Tuesday's election to the state Supreme Court, we have five conservative justices on the court, five elected conservative justices. All of them were backed by the business community, including Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and WMC and the business community likes right-to-work laws, and specifically they pushed really hard for our right-to-work law last year. So I think it's pretty likely that once this legal challenge gets to the state Supreme Court, that the business community is going to win out, and that unions will lose. But as of today, right now, that's not the case. Unions have won this battle in Dane County Circuit Court, and the right-to-work law is struck down.
So given the trajectory this could take, appeals certainly in the future, at least the near future, how significant a victory is this for now?
This is, we haven't seen a legal victory for unions or for Democrats in a while. And I think part of that has to do with challenges to these laws don't always, I guess they aren't always originating in Dane County anymore. Really, a lot of the more controversial legislation that the governor signed into law was front-loaded at the very beginning of his first term. So this is a familiar situation we're in now, a Friday decision that strikes down a controversial law signed by the governor, but we haven't seen one like this in a few years now.
If we're looking at other states that also have right-to-work laws, is there any kind of template that we can look at as a possible roadmap for what happens next?
Yeah, they've been upheld elsewhere, and specifically in federal court and in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appeals court that covers Wisconsin. And so Judge Faust actually addresses that in his decision and kind of gets at the question, well, how is Wisconsin's law different? And I can, just tell you, I haven't read his decision enough to fully explain how he arrives at his conclusion that it is different. But this has been litigated elsewhere, and typically right-to-work laws have been upheld. So, I mean, that's the precedent, and that's kind of what unions would be battling against here.
Well, certainly it brings the issue of right to work back into the public eye for a little while. Is that part of what we're talking about here, sort of reigniting or at least casting a spotlight on what the debate about unions has been in Wisconsin?
It reminds us that these are big issues that we've dealt with recently. And, right to work didn't exactly ignite protests or kind of really even the public's interest in the union debate the way that the governor's Act 10 law did. I mean, Act 10, collective bargaining law for public sector unions, affected teachers, firefighters, you name it. This, when you're talking about private sector unions, it's a narrower group of people. Also, the state had been through that fight over unions before. So the right to work battle was not as tumultuous as the battle over Act 10, but certainly something that unions did not want, something that they were told over and over again they weren't going to see under a Walker administration. So this revives that discussion, and I guess the difference is now it revives it coming in close to an election.
Sean, thanks a lot for coming by the studio today.
You're welcome.
That was WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson giving us the latest on a ruling today that struck down Wisconsin's right-to-work law.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farrak.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll talk to the woman who's being heralded as the keeper of America's cookbook tradition.
First, it's estimated that at least 20% of veterans returning home from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
And while hospitals and researchers have been working on treatment methods to make PTSD less severe for veterans, there's no clear path to healing.
A program in Appleton aims to help Wisconsin veterans come to terms terms with her PTSD through art therapy.
That artwork and stories of soldier experiences have been curated into an art exhibit being showcased now at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.
Michael Telsrow is the director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He curated the War Raw exhibit that's on display at the museum now. He joins us to talk about that collection. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, how did this go from this program in Appleton to an exhibit at the Veterans Museum?
Well, Tim Mayer, who is the guy who runs Artists for the Humanities, approached me several years ago about a project that he thought would have some merit and that I might be interested in. And at first I was sort of unsure about it. He showed me some of the work. It wasn't terribly compelling, but he was pretty persistent. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to look at more of the work that these veterans had done, I just felt that we had to do it. It was one of those things that just we had to do.
And it seems like the story is, it's the art you're looking at, but also this is a case where it came from. The process that created the art is really important.
Really, it really is about the process, and it really is about the emotion and the feelings of these veterans. I mean, some of the work is very competent. We do have some very good artists in the exhibit, but a lot of it are just sort of average veterans who have sort of minimal artistic skills, but you will not be unmoved when you see their work.
Yeah, can you talk us through the exhibit a little bit?
Sure. Well, what you'll see in the exhibit are a number of works that are done on simple paper, simple printing paper. It can be done with crayons. It can be done with pencils. But you'll see what you'll see in this is their feelings largely based on particular events that they've experienced either in Iraq, Afghanistan. Vietnam is well represented as well, but also sort of these abstract feelings that they have. One piece shows television sets, and the subject, the narrator, talks about his feelings, these unstoppable feelings, these intrusive feelings that he has that he can't control, like televisions that are constantly on.
Well, I want to talk about some of the particular pieces of art, and we've got some of these pictures of them on the WPR.org website. One, you mentioned some are from the Vietnam-era veterans who participated. One titled, I Might As Well Go Back to Hell, and it's an anonymous Vietnam veteran showing a crowd on one side, heckling, I guess, a soldier who's standing kind of between hell, the war zone, and home.
Well, he really is between two worlds. You know, he left Vietnam, which was a real hell for him. He comes home and experiences something that is akin to that. It's not combat, but the emotional feelings that he receives when he comes back home. He feels that he might be better off back in Vietnam. So it really is illustrative of the Vietnam experience. Sometimes they feel as though they're in between two worlds.
Is this a common theme you saw from people coming back from other wars as well, this idea that they're not there anymore, but they're not quite here now?
It really is. It's that that feeling of being not being able to reintegrate successfully. So they're sort of in between two worlds at that time. So that is a common theme. It does play out in Iraq and Afghanistan as well.
I want to talk about the audience before we get to some more of the artwork. I imagine a lot of the people coming to the Veterans Museum are veterans themselves.
You know, that is a substantial portion of our visitation, but you'd be surprised. The largest portion of our visitors are not veterans, and that makes sense because veterans are a small portion of the population and a shrinking portion of the population.
I wonder how the veterans who come through react to seeing these artworks by their comrades, their fellow veterans here.
Yeah. You know, I have observed some veterans coming through, and really anyone who goes through that exhibit is moved. So we have had veterans groups come through with counselors, with fellow veterans to make sure that they have some support when they come through, because some of them are suffering from PTSD, some of those veterans who do visit to see the exhibit. I'm happy they come. I think it helps them, and it also lets them know that Artists for the Humanities are out there, and there are other things that can help them.
And you mentioned the majority of the audience, of course, are civilians, people who haven't experienced life in the military. What are you hoping they get out of seeing this, their understanding of veterans?
Well, most of us don't know anyone who has experienced combat. Mm-hmm. And since the veterans population is smaller and shrinking, it gives them an opportunity. It's a window into the veterans' experience, really. And in particular, we hear a lot about PTSD. We're sort of bombarded with that on some occasion. But it really is a tangible way to see what they're going through. You know, these images are very powerful, And I think it's a wonderful way for non-veterans to see what veterans have experienced.
And it's the veterans telling the story in art form themselves. It's really not mediated.
Right, absolutely. It's uncensored. There's no middleman here. Mm-hmm. It's directly from the veteran.
We're talking to Michael Telsrow, director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, looking at the War Raw exhibit at the museum. It's art produced by veterans of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and many of them dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder and other issues on their return to civilian life. I want to get back to some of the art that's on exhibit. A piece by an Army medic named Brian Duca Smith, and it's a painting called View of Our Ramadi, Iraq. Can you tell us about that one?
This is one of my favorite pieces in the exhibit. It's a large painting on canvas, and it depicts from a distance a burning Humvee. And this was a situation where Brian was unable to render assistance to some of his comrades who were inside that Humvee. They were pinned down in Ramadi. They were unable to render assistance. So he's watching this from a distance, and you have this this bird in the foreground here as well, symbolizing the view and being unable to get to his comrades. It's a very, very powerful piece, very large piece, and a very competent piece from an artistic standpoint as well.
And the distance that you're talking about, it's often it's a feeling of if I were closer, I could help, and I'm powerless from this distance.
Exactly. You can see it. You're close enough to see it, but you just can't render that aid. And it must have been absolutely gut-wrenching for Brian.
What was it like going through and curating? I imagine there were a lot of pieces that were created by this this program in Green Bay.
There were a lot. We went through maybe three rounds of selections. Christine Zicker, who was my assistant director at the time, who's now at the Chazen Museum, assisted as well. We looked for those images that were really accessible and readily readily available. Those things that kind of just jumped right out at you. We didn't select some. We had some criteria. We didn't select some that had language issues. We have a broad audience. We have school groups, so we had to leave some of those out. So we went through a couple rounds, and it was quite difficult. There were some that we wanted to include that we ended up not including because we felt that just in deference to the veteran, because some of the veterans were, you know, they weren't told originally when they did these works that they'd be exhibited at a museum. Now they all signed a release that they could be used. So we made some selections based upon content as well. Some of them were frankly just very, very difficult to look at, and we left some of those out.
And these veterans are from Appleton. I think I misspoke and said Green Bay a moment ago. Is this program, this art therapy program, being recreated in other communities?
Well, you know, I think the expressive art therapy is not specific to Appleton and Wisconsin. That's done in many places. But Tim Mayer, who runs this program, has been really good about getting it around the state. He also goes to Toma, the VA hospital in Toma, and does work there. And so he's just been relentless with this program. He's put through, I think, over 2,000 veterans have participated in this particular program.
And you mentioned a wide range of artistic background among the people who participated. And the two examples I gave illustrated that. One, clearly a trained artist, the Brian Duca Smith, is clearly an artist himself. The other one is a person, maybe not a professional artist. How did you get that assortment, I guess, of more and less skilled artists?
Again, that came directly from Tim. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian and Todd Hartwig, who is the other accomplished artists who are featured in the exhibit, went through the program themselves. They were both dealing with PTSD issues. So we were fortunate. It was sort of just a luck of the draw that they had two artists who were competent.
And tell us a little more about what you're doing at the Veterans Museum. This exhibit's on for, I think, exactly one more month. Is that right?
It ends at the end of the month, April 26th, I believe, it comes down. Okay. Our next exhibit is an exhibit called The Art of Persuasion, Mobilizing the Masses in World War I. And that's going to look at art as a propaganda tool, and also examine the role of the CPI, the Committee on Public Information, in shaping public opinion, getting support for the war. So, again, another art exhibit, but with a sort of a political angle as well.
A very timely 100-year anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I coming up in not too long.
On the eve of the centennial in 2017. So we think it'll resonate well.
Well, leave us with a message about the War Raw exhibit. What will viewers take home from this, or what do you hope they take home from this?
Well, I think on a very basic level, I hope that they get a sense of what PTSD really is. You know, as I said earlier, we hear a lot about it. But I think in this exhibit, when you come and look at these images, they're very simple images. It strikes you very quickly. So I think that on a very basic level, I want them to get a sense of what these veterans are going through. And I want them also to understand that it's our obligation, our duty to take care of veterans. When we send people off to do one of the worst things that we can ask them to do, this country has an obligation to take care of its veterans. And so those are the two things I think I want them to come away with.
And briefly, the exhibit, as you say, wrapping up before the end of this month. Can you see doing something like this again down the road at the Veterans Museum?
Sure, absolutely. We are looking to broaden our audience, and I think these types of exhibits do that.
We'll leave it there, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Telsrow. He's director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He joined us on Central Time to talk about the War Raw exhibit at the museum, which showcases work from veterans participating in therapy, expressive art therapy to treat post-traumatic stress. You can see a sampling of that artwork, photos of it, on our website, WPR.org.
Coming up after the news, we'll dig into American culinary history with the woman who's dedicated her life to collecting and preserving American cookbooks. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about the Wisconsin primary, a lawsuit against the State Department of Justice, and more in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, in an age where if you have a craving for a certain food, you can hop online and search for a local restaurant, or if you're feeling really gung-ho, you can search for a recipe to cook online.
But before the internet, cooks had only one resource, the cookbook.
Beyond their use in the kitchen, historical cookbooks are also time capsules of recipes long gone or food traditions that have fallen out of favor.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has spent decades preserving American culinary history through her lifelong passion of collecting cookbooks.
Jan Longoni is the adjunct curator of culinary history in special collections at the University of Michigan. Jan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, you are legendary, I think we could say, in terms of your ability to find and collect these interesting cookbooks. But how did you get started?
Yes, well, it's a long story. My mother said I was born reading a book, and I believe that that's correct. And when I was 5 years old, I wanted to get a library card so I could read more books, and I was not allowed to in Boston, where I grew up, because you had to be able to cross the street yourself. So I evidently threw a tantrum, and they gave me a library card. And now, I don't know if this story is true. That's my urban legend, okay? And I just started reading, but I didn't read cookbooks. I actually read everything else. And then when I was in graduate school, I'm jumping around now, okay? When I was in graduate school at Cornell, I was lucky enough to be involved with a Ford Foundation group who had brought Sputnik had just gone up, and Americans really were very nervous about to go to the world. And they decided that Ford would give money to bring people from all over the world who might be future leaders in every country in the world. And they came to Cornell, and I worked with them, and we would get together every month or so, and people would cook something. And it was always fascinating to me to hear the Northern Indian people say, well, that's not how we make it, you know. And then when they came back to my little apartment, I would say, well, what would you like me to make? I don't know. You know, maybe you have strictures or something. And they said, typical American meal. I didn't know what that was. I grew up in Boston in a Jewish household, and so I went to the library at Cornell, which, of course, had everything, and I started to get into culinary history. And then very shortly after, my husband and I started traveling in Europe under Fulbrights or scholarships and things of that nature. Every place we went, we just decided to learn more about the culinary history. You know, they always wanted to know what to do with me, well, it was my husband who was the one they wanted. And finally, I just learned a great deal. And so when we came back here to Ann Arbor, the university asked if we wouldn't like to give some classes on culinary history. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. Let me see what I can put together.
And you had a lot of cookbooks by that point because you had been, it sounds like, scouring bookstores, antiquarian sites in Europe to find cookbooks. What are some of the most remarkable early ones that you found?
Well, it was not only in America, but also we traveled all over, I mean, in Europe and in Turkey and in North Africa and stuff. But actually, what I should tell you is that, would you ask the question again, please?
Oh, sure. Tell us about some of the books that you found, because you started collecting them and you even started selling them. Which ones stick out to you?
Well, I should tell you that when I started buying cookbooks, scouting, love, having a wonderful time doing that, we spent all of our vacations looking at old books. We loved all sorts of old books. And I discovered I had been buying three copies of a book. And I thought, well, this is strange. Why am I buying three copies? And I say my mind had made up its mind for me to open a bookshop. I didn't know that until I suddenly looked and I thought, what are all these books doing here? And so I started an antiquarian bookshop called the Wine and Food Library. It's one really of the first few in America. In fact, I tell people, you'll forgive me for this, but that they tell me I'm the oldest living culinary antiquarian culinary book dealer in the world.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's true, and some days I think that's a compliment, and some days I wish they wouldn't say it. But so I've had so many books pass through my hands, and if you'll forgive me for jumping ahead and not quite answering your question, I have handled books from 1506 to books that are going to come tomorrow in the mail, okay? Everything between. And my husband, who is an emeritus professor of organic chemistry, shares the passion of studying food and wine and old books. And so we just have done nothing but that, really, for 61 years we've been married. And it's been a wonderful life for us. So we have seen all kinds of books. And you asked a question that is in my mind because I've just been asked, along with many other people, to choose the 10 most important, most interesting books I think need to be need to be made into a facsimile or shown for people. Someone is trying to do something called 1,000 books, and they've asked all sorts of people to give 10 books. Well, I have not been able to decide which 10 books
hard to pick.
I want to give them. But since I really was featuring, when I started all of this, I really was not interested in American cookbook history. I was very interested in French history, French gastronomy. But very soon, a man named Alan Davidson, who is a founder of modern culinary history, asked me if I would come to Oxford University in England and speak on the history of American cookbooks. And I remember saying, Alan, I don't know anything about American cookbooks. I'm not interested. Why don't you ask me to speak about French cookbooks? And he said, Jan, anyone can talk about French cookbooks, but not very many people can talk about American. So I want you to come and speak at Oxford at a symposium. So I said, I can't do it. I'm not prepared to do it, and I won't give a talk unless I'm prepared. So he said, okay, I'm going to give you 3 days, and I want you to decide who else could do it but you. By this time, I had had the bookshop for many years, and I had made many contacts. I mean, every important chef in America, every winemaker, every cheesemaker, you know, they all were customers in my bookshop, which was such a lucky thing for me. It was wonderful. And I'm jumping around, but anyway, so I went,
Well, I'm going to jump in for a second and let people know we're listening to Jan Longoni. She is known as America's foremost culinary historian, a collector of American cookbooks. And Jan, I want to get into some specific pieces of American history here. I understand among the books that you've collected at the University of Michigan now, the first known cookbook written by an African-American woman in the country. What is it like to discover, to get your hands on something like that?
Well, that's one of my most favorite books, and I would be more than happy to talk about it. For many years, people thought the first African-American cookbook was written by a woman named Mrs. Fisher, and it was called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking. Mrs. Fisher, we believe, was a slave, and after the Civil War, she moved with her family to California, and there she became, she started to cook, she started to cook and make things and work with the highest class of people in Oakland and San Francisco. And they asked her to write a cookbook, which, did I say that, was called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking. And everyone thought that was the first black authored cookbook by a woman. And one day I was in Boston. My mother was ill. And my husband called me up. He said, Jan, what do you know about a black authored cookbook from Michigan from 1866? And I said, there is no such thing. We've seen it all these years. We've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of books. He said, well, someone just called and wanted you to tell her about it. So I said, well, why don't you tell her to send it to us, and we'll look and decide. I just can't believe that there's an 1866 cookbook written by a black American. So when I got back in town, we waited, and I said, we'd send the book. So we got the book, and we opened it up, and I took a look at it, and I thought, my God, this is 15 or more years before Mrs. Fisher, by a woman named Melinda, M-A-L-I-N-D-A, Melinda Russell. And Melinda was a free woman of color because her mother was a free woman of color because her grandmother was made free in Virginia. And Melinda was an unbelievable person. I say she's an indomitable spirit. And I also say what she is an African-American story and an American story. So anyway, so she started doing cooking in Tennessee, where she was born. And then she worked in various parts of Tennessee. And then she owned a bakery. And during the Civil War, she was so pro-union that men in masks and guns came to her and said, you better get out of the South. So she was forced out of the South, and she lost all her money, everything. She lost everything. I forgot to say, she started to go to Liberia, Back to Africa movement, and someone robbed her. She got married. Her husband died young, and she had a child who was born, quote, handicapped. So they marched her out of Tennessee, and she heard that Michigan was the garden of the world, and she ended up in Paw Paw, Michigan.
Wow, what a story, and I know that's just one of the many that you've got there. We're talking right now with Jan Longoni. She's the adjunct curator of culinary history and special collections at the University of Michigan. We're talking with her for our Food Friday today and talking about how a passion for cookbooks turned into a lifelong journey to preserve American culinary history.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of older American cookbooks? Are these an important part of our history, maybe an important part of your family history? Do you have a treasured cookbook that's been handed down through the generations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Jan Longoni on this Food Friday. She's the adjunct curator of culinary history and special collections at the University of Michigan.
And she's a historical cookbook collector extraordinaire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite classic cookbook, or maybe a question about one? Do you have a cookbook that's been handed through the generations in your family? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a call now for Jan. We've got Russ on the line in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I've been collecting cookbooks my whole life since I started getting interested in cooking. I'm currently a chef owner of a little restaurant my wife and I run, but I always like to say that I learned cooking because I was never formally trained through the cookbooks I collected, and then the television programs like Julia Child and all those going way back. But I've got love Jacques Pepin, and I've got a copy of his first edition of La Technique, which was a big book he produced that was had lots of black and white photos on how to debone a chicken and cut an onion. But it's really a great book. I also have there's a guy from the 80s, the Frugal Gourmet, Jeff Smith, out of Washington State. Really great guy. I think he kind of died dishonored for something. I don't know. But his books were so spot on in the recipes, and they're always my favorite, and I still go back to them to this day. His one book, The Cuisine of the Three Great Dynasties, I think China, Rome, and Greece, has just some amazing, great recipes that, like I said, and I actually use some of the recipes in my restaurant today.
Oh, fabulous, Russ. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Someone who shares your passion there, Jan. Do you have any brief thoughts about the cookbooks that he mentioned there?
Yes, I do. I wish I could go to his restaurant. Tell him. That would be very nice. So, but people really relate to the cookbooks, and they relate to the ones that belonged to their families that were handed down in the family. But they just really care about the books, and it's quite remarkable. And as I say, our archive at the university, which is called the Janus Blustein Longoni Culinary Archive, that archive has, 40,000 books now that we have donated. And they go back to the 16th century, but of course there are many more modern ones than that, and they're from all cultures, but mostly American.
And Jan, you shared a recipe with us with some history behind it, the David Eyre pancake. We've got that up on the Central Time Facebook page. What's the story behind this pancake recipe?
Well, I think I first found it maybe in a book by, I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, but a little of significance.
Times, yeah. New York Times food editor, and it's called David, I think it's called David Eyre. And it's one of these things that it takes 10 minutes to do, and it's delicious, and everybody likes it. But recently I was asked to send a recipe, Craig Claiborne, Craig Claiborne. Recently I was asked to send a card with my favorite recipe to a great-niece who's getting married in a few weeks. And I thought, what can I make? I don't know her too well, and it would be nice. So I'll send her the David Eyre, which I did. The David Eyre that I sent you the recipe for is a sweet one. You finish it off with butter and sugar. But my husband and I prefer savory things. So what we do is we use Parmesan instead of sugar.
Oh, that's a good way to go. Yes. This is one of these big, puffy, sort of German-style Pannkuchen sorts of things, right? It's
exactly.
A puffy pancake.
Yes, and it's so easy to make. And all you need are two eggs. I think that's right. Yes, two eggs. You can feed two people for a light lunch, and I recommend it highly. And the second one, do you want me to talk about that
one? Sure, yes, some Parmesan shortbread or something.
It's a Parmesan shortbread, and this comes from, I think, Bon Appetit or Food and Wine, I can't remember. And it's they're absolutely wonderful if you're having company over and you want something that you can cook in advance, make it in, or bake in advance. And this simply is a shortbread, and you can put, this is with Parmesan, but we have had it with Parmesan, we've had it with rosemary, we've had it with blue cheese, you know, whatever you want, and everyone likes it. And I've never been to a wine tasting, and I go to many, that people have and said, can I have the recipe? Can I have the recipe? So that was why I gave you that as the second one.
And we've got both of those recipes. You can have that recipe at the Central Time Facebook page. I want to bring another caller on, Jan. We've got Jean on the line in Appleton. Jean, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Virtually certain she must have a copy of the Victory Cookbook, Wartime Edition.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
My favorite.
It has 816 pages and even tells you how to buy food And at the end, there's a supplement on how to feed a family of five on $15 a week.
Jean, thanks. And I bet that's all, there's a lot of history there of wartime ration-ready cookbooks, Jan.
Yes. Just to tell you, yes, I know that book very well, but I can tell you we also have from the 1890s books called How to Feed a Family of Six on 15 cents a day.
Oh, boy. That's a different time.
Yeah, a different time.
So these cookbooks really are a window to the past. Do you feel like it is possible to know people really well and really fully through the food that they eat?
Yes, I think so. I think so. And I think, in America we have still have some kind of fear of food. I think not now. It's changed maybe in the last 15 years. And we were afraid to use butter. There's a book out to teach Italians. Good ladies who were doing charity cookbooks said, my God, they're using olive oil. They better use butter instead. We're not afraid of these things, and we're not afraid to try things. And I don't know about, I'm sure in your campuses, too, in Wisconsin, the students are getting so very interested. They're doing farm gardens. They're doing helping poor people with their food, feeding people. You know, it's just so exciting and interesting to me that all of this has happened. When I started the bookshop, which was in 1972, I mean, there weren't a lot of people who were collecting cookbooks or who were really interested in the subject. And it took years and years and years before we could get academia to say, this is a subject worth studying. And there are famous chefs now who are teaching at Harvard University. And all over the country, they're talking about food. And part of it is because we're worried about agriculture. We're worried about... After the First World War, the American government discovered that so many people could not be accepted as soldiers because they were not in good health. They weren't eating right, they weren't exercising properly, etc. So that's when we started to really talk about food and what is food. And there's just so much happening, and it's a thrill to be involved in the food world. Let's put it that way.
What's a wonderful story you've shared with us, Jan. Thank you so much for sharing these historical cookbooks with us today.
Thank you very much for asking me.
That's Jan Longoni. She's the adjunct curator of American Culinary History and Special Collections at the University of Michigan's Hatcher Library. She joins us to talk about her work really preserving a big part of American history, culinary history, through cookbooks. And by the way, she shared a couple of her favorite recipes. We've got those the pancakes and the Parmesan shortbreads. You can find both of those at the Central Time Facebook page. Older recipes, but I'm sure they're still really good.
Right. I think I'm going to try that, David. Pancake.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It sounds delicious.
Sounds like and Finnish pancakes.
It's something cool thinking about it, a recipe from history, too.
Definitely. Eat a piece of history.
This is Central Time. In some ways, it's been a time of transition here at WPR. We welcomed two new producers to Central Time in the last couple of months. Halima Shah is one of them, and she's with us in studio. Hey, Halima.
Hi there.
If you call in, you'll be hearing her voice at the other end of the phone some days here on Central Time. And as she comes in, we're also saying goodbye today to Joy Cardine producer Christy Taylor.
Right. She's going on to a job as a producer at NPR Science Friday, which is super cool.
Also super cool treats today, including Twinkies, which we discovered, Halima, you'd never eaten before.
I have never had a Twinkie before today.
And so we have to explain this. How can you get to a ripe old age, anyway, past the age of 10, and not have had a Twinkie?
I was never attracted to them. Frankly, when I look at a Twinkie, I just see an elongated, dried vanilla cupcake stuffed with whipped cream.
When does that get bad? So what did you think of it, though?
I wasn't that impressed. You know, I feel like people like Twinkies because of their nostalgic value.
They are nostalgic. I get that. And while we were talking about this in the hall, all these people crawled out of the woodwork. You're not alone. Lots of people have not had Twinkies, which I would not have believed possible.
All right. So you're not going to, you know, join the Twinkie of the Month Club tomorrow?
I'm not. And I mean, I grew up in the Chicago area. half an hour from where the world's first Twinkie was invented in 1930. And, like, that's my relationship with Twinkies. It came into my consciousness when they shut down the Twinkie factory, like, 2 years ago.
Well, that was Halima Shah, one of the new producers here on Central Time.